This is your guide to book publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask, with your host, Dr. Judith Briles. On the show today, you'll find out where book publishing is going and how to take advantage of it. How to identify and avoid publishing predators. What opportunities are emerging as the book trade evolves in new forms. How to avoid losing money, and much, much more. Join us now as a variety of publishing pros will deliver insights and strategies to take the author to the next level of publishing. It's your guide to book publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. Brought to you by Author U and The Book Shepherd. And now, here's your host, Dr. Judith Briles.
Well, welcome back to this week's edition of the Author U, Your Guide to Book Publishing cast. And we're going to do a little twist. We've never done a show on fantasy writing, epic fantasy writing. And I thought it was time to do a deep dive into it. So with that said, my guest and I will be supplying lots of tips and strategies and ahas and insights and fun in the process, so you become a more successful author with your book marketing, your book writing, and certainly your book publishing. I always like to start our shows with a quote from my book, Snappy, Sassy, Salty Success, and this is perfect for today. Writing is the last frontier. There are no limits, no boundaries, just sheer imagination. With me today is epic fantasy writer. His true name is David Savine, but he goes by the pen name of Louis Savon, and that's how you will find him. He views his writing and books as a relief, an escape from the breaking news of everyday life. He's the author of the Amazon best-selling College of Sorcerers trilogy, and is currently rolling out the Tower of Sin trilogy with his latest book, Book 4, Thaddeus and the Ancient One, to be followed this fall by Thaddeus and the Emperor. So, David, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Nice to talk with you again.
Oh, yes. Yeah, since yesterday. How's that? Okay, so with that, you know, I always like to ask authors, when I do have them on the air, is why do they write? So I'm going to ask that of you. Why write? And how did you land in the genre of epic fantasy?
Okay, well, why write? There really wasn't an option. I think it was just an inner force that just kept bubbling away. It just had to be released, almost biologic in form, really. Couldn't help not do it. In terms of epic fantasy, that is more to do with the fact of a resonance I had with that growing up. I have always loved epic fantasy or science fiction as well. And I used to take Edgar Rice Burroughs books, for example, to school and read them during recess. It was just always a passion. So when I started to write, I think that was the genre that just was there. And so I just started tapping into it.
And so it called to you. So when did you start writing?
Well, I started writing, I've been writing off and on all my career. I was in healthcare initially, but in school, my sister was an editor for NASA, and we would write sometimes books and stories together over the years. And then I had an opportunity in the 80s to join with two other professional colleagues and write a textbook on biofeedback, which was relatively new at the time. And that kind of whetted my taste. And then in the 90s, I wrote a political satire on, had to do with government and psychology and dark matters. But then in the 90s, late 90s and early 2000s, I began to consider the current series I've been working with. And once I got started, I just had to go.
It took you over, basically?
Oh, pretty much. A lot of spare time. Of course, then once I was able to retire, then I've been the schedule's been a little looser. But yeah, I would spend very early mornings and sometimes very late nights and lots of times weekends writing. However, as I have heard it said by other authors, you can't always write just when you want. There were days when I could sit in front of the computer for hours, nothing would happen. But other times it just flowed out so fast I could hardly type it and keep up.
Yeah, you mentioned your sister as an editor for NASA. Did I hear that right? Okay.
Yes.
So was that part of the springboard to go into the fantasy world?
Not that especially. That was more an effect rather than a cause. No, the fantasy world thing, like I said, that goes way back. That goes way back. I think when I was around 4 or 5, my folks took me to see the Walt Disney animated film Fantasia. And you may know or you may recall, depending on if you want to admit it or not, age-wise, it had such elements as dinosaurs and fairies and all kinds of magical creatures and situations, and I was captivated by that.
Hmm. I remember the scene of Fantasia where Mickey is at like this giant pot and he's brewing up some stew. And
yeah, Sorcerer's Apprentice. Yes. Absolutely.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Okay. And I just didn't know what to expect, but it kind of spooked me a little bit. So I remember that scene. It is still embedded. All right. Now we've all marked our age here. when that came out during it. So, well, now that you're retired, do you have a typical writing day? I mean, you're still writing.
Yes, it depends pretty much on what administration has in mind for me. But on times when I'm left to myself, usually I'll be working on something. I just get in my recliner and sit at the desk and get the laptop out and see where I left off last time and just go as long as I can or until. Till it's time to get up and do something else. But when there are vacuums in time, then I just go right ahead, take advantage. I relish them sometimes.
So do you have you mentioned your writing desk or your recliner. Are those your writing spots?
Yes, mostly usually.
Most usually. All right. You have, when you first started and the first book, is Thaddeus
of Bewick.
Yeah. Did you know that was going to be the first book? Or did they start?
Yes. Well, I had the series in mind. And again, like I've heard other writers say, including myself in that August company, but like I've heard other people say, they sometimes or often or say that they have kind of a story, they kind of have an idea of how it might go, and they know how the ending is. And that's always been the case with me. I knew that what the ending would be, so it was like kind of working toward that. But I had originally conceived the idea of my series, I'd say in the late 70s, just thinking about what fun it might be and what mischief there might be in going to a school where they taught sorcery. All the pranks you could come up with and all the ways to get in trouble, so to speak. And just I used to think about that quite a bit. So I was thinking, well, it might be fun to actually try and describe that. And you'd be faced, of course, by experienced faculty who had seen it all before, and so you might think you could get away with this or that, but then, of course, they'd be two steps ahead, and then the tension between the two sides would go on and finally resolve at the time of graduation. But that's kind of where I started out. But then as I got closer and closer to actually putting pen to paper, I began to think that, well, you can't just list a series of, you know, funny incidents. You really should give some structure to this and frame it up into something that might be a little more meaningful and tell a story. And I always have enjoyed telling stories. That's just been a thing I've liked to do. And so I said, well, I'll take these ideas and try and tell a story from it. And so I kind of knew how it was going to go. It was going to start with a group of young people who would go through various adventures and ultimately come out victorious. Old school, but then that's sort of where I came from, my tradition, and so it felt very comfortable and very familiar.
Okay, so we're 1 minute from our first break, but what I wanted to do is let's go ahead and set the stage. We've got young people, we've got the old school way, I guess they kind of grew up, or maybe not during those times. I know that your books are set, and we don't say the word Middle Earth because someone else owns that phrase. But in the Dark Ages, back in the Dark Ages, and an alternative universe. So what I would love to have you do is, when we come back, is kind of set the stage of how you created your alternative universe. And what were the key components, and were there things that you thought there were going to be there, but you dumped them? And then others that emerged in that process as you went along, all right? And so with that said, we will be right back.
This is your guide to book publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. With your host, Dr. Judith Briles. And we'll be right back with more great information right after these.
Is there a book in you? Or another? Author U shows you how to create, develop, and publish your book without being hoodwinked. If you already have a book out, you will find a supportive and brainstorming community that is connected and creative, no matter where you live. Author U brings in national experts for its book camps and annual Author U Extravaganza. It has regular meetings and delivers webinars for its members on timely topics. Through Author U's extensive network, members enjoy exclusive benefits, including significant discounts for a variety of services necessary to publishing. Author U is the premier authoring resource in the country, creating community, education, guidance, vision, and success for the serious author. If you want to create a book that has pizzazz, punch, and panache, Author U is for you. Timely author and publishing tips and articles are posted on its social media platforms, and it is free. Discover Author U, where authors go to become seriously successful. Join Author U today at authoru.org.
Welcome back to your guide to book publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. If you want to write and publish a book, if you want to be successful as an author, your guide to book publishing, everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask, is for you. Stay tuned and you'll hear about statistics, scenarios, and strategies on what to do now to get you published. So let's get back to the show. And here again is your host, Dr. Judith Briles.
With me for this episode of the Author U, Your Guide to Book Publishing podcast is, in real life, David Savine. He writes under the pen name of Louis Savine, and that's LouisSavine.com. So visit his website. He has a very nifty, you can find out what your astrology sign is in the dark ages, and check that out and find out who you really are on that. So David, let's talk about some of these strategies. So you have this vast imagination. You're a great storyteller. I think of you as a master storyteller. Your books have all been bestsellers on Amazon. And I do want to tell everyone that you can find him under either Louis Savine, or his titles would include Thaddeus, and they're all Thaddeus, T-H-A-D-D-E-O-U-S, is always in the title. And then it's just what the rest is. The beekeeper is number one. Number two is the master. Number three is the demon. And the fourth baby just came out, the ancient one, that you can find them that way. So world building, how do you do it? Where do you start?
Well, for me, it was by having read a number of books. You know, you stand on the shoulders of those who came before you. So, I became aware over time just that most of the people who write in this area do have a world that's other than our own everyday reality. And so in order to have that world and fill it with what they want to fill it with, they have to create it. And so if you're going to create a world, then you have to have a, you know, a physical place or plane. And you're going to inhabit it with various beings of one type or another, and then you're going to have events that occur. So, yeah, the world building is, the first initial step in the technical process, because without that, it's just random sentences that won't really mean anything to anybody. For fantasy, it's much more difficult to have to explain, I guess, fantasy, the currents of fantasy in the real world that we have today, unless you want to go into politics.
No, we won't go there. We're not doing politics.
then it is if you make up your own world. If you're making up a world and assuming you can take the audience will go along with you on it, then you can, you know, you can create whatever you want. You can have it go any way you want. You have that. And that power is a bit intoxicating in a sense. So it's fun to do. But you do have to, I think, follow certain precepts. If you want to make it believable, you at least, I think, have to make some sort of connections between the real world and the world that you're building. You know, you've got to consider, are you going to have grass and trees and dirt and gravity and stars and moons and heat and cold and on and on and on. You know, you have to make all these decisions. The closer you get to what reality is, our reality, in your fantasy world, the closer it is, the less time you have to put in explaining it. If you wanted to have some really quite far out and unusual occurrence, then you're going to have to spend a lot more time, put a lot more work into it. And being inherently lazy, it seemed to me it would be easier to do it the former way.
All right. So how long, or maybe I ask you this, how long have you adjusted it as it went along, as your characters started to develop and the elements started falling into place? Did it get altered from your original concept?
Initially, the first trilogy, the first three books, not so, because they took place all in the same world. And I had been thinking about that for a decade or two before, as I said, before I actually put it down on paper. So I had a pretty good idea. Plus, putting it in the earthly equivalent of the Dark Ages or medieval times, I had done some research, you know, over the years about that. So I had some knowledge about that, I thought, and I tried to introduce that into the writing and make it plausible. I think that's part of taking your audience along with you. Making it plausible makes it easier for the reader, I think, to follow. But then the second trilogy was different, because then in the second trilogy, our character goes to a very different place indeed from where we started. And that one, I hadn't quite thought through. I hadn't, or at least I hadn't spent as much time on it. So constructing it was required more effort and more thought and, again, more research. And then in the third trilogy, our character comes back and more familiar turf, so to speak, and it got easier again.
Well, I guess easy would be good. As you go along. So, you know, in your research, because you do a lot of research, you're kind of a wordsmith when I think of you. Is there a time when your pure fiction fantasy crosses over to real historical happenings?
Parallels, I would say.
Parallel. Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't actually use real events that happen, but I might quote unquote borrow them and then modify them to fit what the storyline is or what the environment is, the world is in the fantasy I have. But in terms of such things as customs, mores of the times and the people mm-hmm. in a dark age setting, then I try to follow that pretty closely, again, to be more plausible. But real events, no.
All right. So it's just your imagination gets to take off. That's what I'm hearing.
The real world is sort of a model, and then I try to take that and modify it into something that seems fun and interesting and unusual.
You know, I'm thinking out loud. I'm wondering if the word fantasy saves your bacon when you have a lot of these people who devour historical fiction, but if there is one little iota out of place, they go nutso. But for the fantasy, that means we're in the pretend world and so back off. At least that's my kind of take here.
Yeah, and you can get away with that up to a point. I mean, wait a minute. You had two knights on the road coming to fight the dragon, but in the final scene, there were three. What happened? And you can always say, well, a sorcerer added that one.
or he gave birth.
You don't have to go into great deal of detail. Yeah, we couldn't get away with that anything real.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the creation of your characters and the conflicts they get into or out of. So, you know, I've already mentioned Thaddeus. He's your main guy, the main lad in the process. All right, so how did you come up with his name and the names of the other elements within the series and creating who they were?
Okay. Sure. Thaddeus was, actually I was going through a bookstore one time. Oh geez, 20, 30 years ago. I was going through a bookstore, and I was back in the science fiction and fantasy section. That's where I usually spend time. And I was looking at the titles, and they had these very, how would you describe it? Very, very sort of traditionally, or maybe even toxically, masculine names and adventuresome names and hero names and so on many of the books. And I was thinking, you know, it might be interesting to, as a kind of a way to capture someone's eye, to come up with a name for a hero that you wouldn't expect particularly. You might think of Marcus the Bold or Tarragon the Adventurer or whatever, but you might not think of Thaddeus right away as a hero. You might think of him as a scholar or perhaps a priest stuck in some monastery, but not necessarily a hero. So I thought, well, that might be fun. So I said, well, I'll make Thaddeus a hero. His name might be a little different, but he'll have the same sorts of other qualities that you often, I think, find or tend to find in heroes. But that's how he came about.
Okay.
Now, in terms of the other
characters. But you have so many more. Did you know, because he has associates. I think that's what we call him, his associates.
Yes, yes.
Did you always know that there were going to be a certain number of them or their characteristics, or did they kind of evolve, develop, talk to you as you started writing them?
Yes. Well, clearly he had to have companions to accomplish what he needs to accomplish over the course of the book, and I had an idea about that. And I thought, well, you know, what sort of companions? And I wanted to identify people that would be easier to differentiate from one another. For example, if he had three other companions and all of them were heroes or hero-like, how would you really be able to differentiate them one from another? So, in this case, I picked him out as a sort of a backcountry lad, and then I added a scholar who came from a well-established family, and then I added a street thief, and then I added a southern prince. So they were all easier to write that way because they were different from each other. They didn't blend into one another, and then I could develop them separately, so that was easier. And then the ladies, and I'll tell you a secret. I've never told anyone. I'll tell you a secret. The ladies, all of them actually represent ex-girlfriends from high school. So I just kind of borrowed that.
From high school?
Yeah, don't share that with administration. I'd prefer you didn't.
Now, say again what exactly you just did.
Well, I had several, like most people do, you go through high school and you have relationships. And there were four particular ladies I had during the 4 years, and I just kind of borrowed them from my heroines.
Well, there you go. Why not?
Yep, that's what I thought. But like I said, please don't mention it.
So are you telling me Molly was really in your life, or was that her name?
Well, there was a person like that, yes. Now, a couple of them do, their names are very similar to what the real names are, and a couple aren't.
We're going to come right back. We'll be back with David.
This is your guide to book publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. With your host, Dr. Judith Briles. And we'll be right back with more great information right after these.
Discover the power of you and your book at the Judith Briles Unplugged events. Each summer, Judith Briles Book Marketing Unplugged unfolds over 3 intensive days working with just Judith. You get publishing strategies, author and book platforms, book marketing panache and pizzazz, and authoring tools to take you and your book to rock star success. In the fall and winter, Judith Briles Speaking Unplugged includes Judith as your coach and mentor during 2 powerful days. You will learn how to structure a speech, how to create openings and closings, how to find gigs that pay you and sell your books, and you will get one-on-one coaching. Go to thebookshepherd.com and click on the events tab to learn how to participate at the next Unplugged Workshop event.
Welcome back to your guide to book publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. Coming up, you'll hear more about statistics, scenarios, and strategies on what to do now to get you published. So let's get back to the show. And here again is your host, Dr. Judith Briles.
So we were talking in the previous segment with David about the creation of his characters and conflicts, and they're young people. Young people. And one of the things that happens, in fact, it's a requirement, that sex enters the scene. Have you ever gotten any pushback from readers or maybe other editors before I started working with you?
Oh, yes. When I was finally able to get someone interested in the story, which did, and that took a while, but when that happened, this was the time was approximately at the time when you began to have a lot of people talking about the Me Too movement and all the folks that that involved. And when they looked at the story then, where I proposed that a requirement become someone who could use sorcery, was that they have a loving, intimate relationship, including the physicality part. Some people felt that that was pretty risky, particularly if you're talking about teenagers. Now, I always would say, well, you know, if we're looking at the Dark Ages, if we're looking at a medieval type of setting, that was not uncommon in those days, partly because people didn't live that long. Perhaps in some areas, the average life expectancy might only be 30 years. So you would have, not uncommonly, particularly among certain classes, you would have people who would be married or have relationships with people who were perhaps 12, 13, 14, very different from how things are today, but those were the times. And as an example, I would point out that apparently Juliet, in Romeo and Juliet, was, I believe, to be indicated to be 14. John of England, who the Magna Carta fellow, Robin Hood guy, his wife was 13 when they married, and they had a long and loving relationship. So in those days, I don't think it was considered that unusual. And since I was writing about the Dark Ages, and since I wanted to get these relationships established, I thought it would be, you know, okay to do that. The other thing I had in the back of my mind was there is a fantasy writer, David Eddings is his name, and in his story, he took the opposite view. He I believe, indicated that it would not be good for there to be personal or loving or intimate relationships between young people before you learned or could start practicing your magic. But I thought it would be interesting the other way. And the third part of it was, I was thinking, if you were the school administrator, let's say, of a school of sorcery, and you were sort of an administrative type, and you were recruiting students and their parents would come in and so forth, and your task was to explain why this was a necessary condition, I said, I thought that would be interesting to write about. So that's where that came from.
So what I'm hearing from you, David, is you read, you're doing a lot of research and probing in and are in reading other authors, or would you recommend you to do that? Other authors who are writing it to find out what's out there?
I don't know that answer. I haven't studied it enough to be intelligent in that area. But what I would guess would be that it may be different for each person who writes. And also would depend entirely or a lot on the type of subject he's writing about, the type of genre the person may pick. You know, some people may want to write from their inner experience or just their observation of people around them or this, that, and the other thing, depending on what the genre they pick. And they may be more interested in primary processes or just the you know, lower all the filters and see what comes out. You know, that's that kind of writing. Whereas there may be other people, as you mentioned earlier, who would lean more toward the historical side, and they would either want to get it right so that the readers would follow along with them, or they'd want to get it right because of some inner duty they felt to adhere to the fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, but for you, do you read other authors that write in your
genre?
Yes,
so like when I was growing up, I read as much as I could get a hold of. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. You have a unique character. And I know when I first started talking with you that I posed the question for all our listeners, he has a snarky, smart mule in it. And Acellus is his character. Where'd he come from?
Well, there is a serial of movies back in the day had to do with a mule character named Francis. Francis the Talking Mule.
Remember Francis the Talking Mule?
Yeah. And I used to watch those, and I always kind of thought that was fun. And then I was also thinking, this our hero, when he starts out, is pretty much alone. I mean, he gets yanked out of his comfortable backcountry life with his family and friends around him. He gets yanked out of that abruptly, and then he's going to some place and do something completely different than what he ever expected to. And I thought, that's a difficult journey. That's a difficult transition. So I thought if he had a companion maybe to go along with him, so like a sidekick from one of the old Westerns, you know, that might be interesting. And I thought, you know, my first thought was, well, what about a dog? And I thought, well, you know, there's such a size difference usually, and a talking dog, I didn't know. And so I thought, well, how about a horse? And I thought, well, a kid from the back country, how's he going to get a horse? That's a little lofty for someone just starting out, maybe. And so then I thought, well, what about a mule? So I got this mule, and then I thought, as a sort of a kick, it might be fun to give him one of the worst accents I've ever heard. It's an attempt. It's really comedic, I hope, but an attempt to be sort of a Celtic sort of dialogue that he comes up with all the time. But he would be a companion. He would be sort of the wiser companion who's steadfastly loyal and protective, and so our hero would not feel so alone and isolated on his journey. And then as time went on, and I had written this, and we launched these books and so on, I've been getting so much feedback from people, the two or three who do, but I've been getting so much feedback that they really enjoy this character. If they have any character in the book that they tend to favor, the mule's name is very often mentioned. And so there's something about him. I'm not sure entirely what, but there's something about it that seems to resonate with people. In fact, I had one person the other day ask me when the plush toy for this mule was going to be out on the market.
No, that's funny. Why not?
Thinking, that'd be a good idea. That'd be a good idea.
Well, maybe for a prop on a book table. Maybe, maybe for a prop. And then you can learn to be a... you know, mimic his voice with his accent and all that. You know, it's, you know, Estella sounds like he's from Ireland, everybody.
Yeah. Hey, we do that for Sarton.
All right. So when you first started writing, in what year did you start putting this series together?
98.
So you were... a few years ahead of ever the Shrek movie coming out.
Yes.
You were the prototype for Shrek.
Maybe, whatever.
Yeah. But people do wonder when they see those similarities, and Celis is, besides snarking, that he really is a protector of Thaddeus too. Yeah.
Yes.
It goes along. All right. So my question is, how, when you're writing, do your characters start talking back to you, guide you? Do they resist some of the ways you're writing?
In a way, it's like when I get to a situation and if our hero sees something, does something, says something, I almost know it just comes from the wellspring, wherever that may be, from inside, in terms of what the response will be. Mm-hmm. If they're in a situation or they're talking to someone or doing an activity or whatever, I just have a sense that if you have in mind the character, the mule, his comrades, his lady friend, whoever, if you have an idea of how that's going to be, then they will speak very characteristic. Like you're not going to hear the street thief start to talk in using high language. You're not going to hear the scholar start swearing or doing things. You're not going to hear the prince talking like an alleged peasant might. So you have it. If you've developed the characters, I think, in your mind, it makes it easier to put on paper what they might say. And it becomes, after a time, in some ways, almost automatic.
And so that you'll just, I know what I do writing with my writing partner. I will stop him when he goes down a path because I know these characters well enough that they would not behave this way.
Yes, yes. You get a sense of what their boundaries and limits are, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and mm-hmm. and exploiting those and then describing them, hopefully in an interesting way, will bring the reader along, and perhaps the reader will enjoy the interactions.
I would hope so. All right, so we're getting close to our final break here. And what I would love to have you come back and kind of do, I don't know if you had a visual timeline going across or it was all in Word documents or whatever, but I would love to have you walk our readers through how you developed that world, laying it out to keep you on track as it evolved. We'll be right back, everyone. You're listening to Your Guide to Book Publishing.
This is Your Guide to Book Publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. With your host, Dr. Judith Briles. And we'll be right back with more great information right after these.
Oh, what a night. Are you confused about publishing options? Do you know which printing option is best for your book? Does your stomach flip when you think about selling books? Or do you feel overwhelmed with what to do about book marketing and publicity? Get the answers and much more. Get them and from someone who knows publishing inside and out from both the traditional and independent sides how to make a successful book. You can't do it alone without paying the price. You can spend your money creating a book that turns out to be so-so. Or you can create a book that looks and feels classy, builds your brand and platform, and is a success, a bestseller. It is your choice. You choose. If you want author and publishing success, you want Judith Briles as your book coach. Sign up for her weekly blogs and e-zine at thebookshepherd.com. The book shepherding concept is simple. The publishing world is changing, and so must you. You need an experienced shepherd and guide to collaborate with you as you create, strategize, develop, publish, and achieve your publishing goals. Publishing is riddled with obstacles, sometimes nightmares for the author. You do not need more problems. You want solutions. Dr. Judith Riles will shepherd you through the maze and chaos. At times, she has had to step in and rescue a book that has been sabotaged by a publisher, by a publishing service provider, and sometimes even by the author. If you want author and book success, connect with her today at thebookshepherd.com.
Welcome back to Your Guide to Book Publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. If you want to write and publish a book, if you want to be successful as an author, Your Guide to Book Publishing, Everything You Want to Know But Didn't Know What to Ask, is for you. Stay tuned and you'll hear about statistics, scenarios, and strategies on what to do now to get you published. So let's get back to the show. And here again is your host, Dr. Judith Riles.
Well, with me is David Savine, who writes as Louis Savine. And again, his website is Louis Savine, SAUVAIN.com. So I would definitely do a checkout. But his books are available all on Amazon. They have kissed the magic bestseller list in so many categories. If you're a Kindle Unlimited, you can read it through for free because it's included in your membership. And every once in a while, David throws something up and he offers the ebook for free for a couple of days. So do a follow of what he is about. We've been talking about the development of world building. So he's in the Dark Ages, kind of the 10th, 11th century, I'm going to assume. But it's an alternative universe, epic fantasy. He's got this kick, really. Aeschylus is one of the favorite characters. Certainly we're always looking for what he is up to, thinking about, doing, resisting. One of the things that David includes in his book, these extensive maps. And I know when I gave the set to my grandson, who loves epic fantasy, he loved the detail of the maps. Did you always see having maps in your books?
Oh, yes. Basically, because I love to read books that had maps in them to begin with. I always thought that was cool, so I thought, well, if I ever would write a book, I would certainly put maps in it.
Mm-hmm. And so did you have an actual professional ancient map maker in play? I mean, how did you find these people?
There were several things I needed to do. I needed to have an illustrator. I needed to have a map maker. I needed to have a Latin translator and so on. And this was at a time when you had to be cautious, as always, with one's economics. So I thought and thought and thought, and I figured out, well, I bet if I went to the local college and to the Department of Fine Arts and talked to the chairperson, that maybe they could point me in the direction of an interested student. And I thought such a person might have a lot of interest or enthusiasm in starting out a project like this, and also wouldn't mind getting paid for it. So that was the direction I went. And so each of those categories I mentioned earlier, I was able to find a student or graduate student who was happy to work on these things. And that's where all that came from. I told him, for example, in the case of the map, I suggested what I had in mind and what to look, what to have down, what the geography might be, and so forth. They would provide a rough drawing after a time, and then we'd work on refining it. And the same with the other parts.
Well, I think that's I know I believe in interns and all that, but I sometimes forget about going back to the college and like fine arts, because students are would be a lesser cost than someone who does this for a living. And they're looking to build their portfolios also, that they can show their work. So this is a great way for all of you listeners who are thinking about doing any map-related work or illustration and wondering, where do I go? Where do I go? What can I do? And taking advantage of that. So I like that. And the maps are very detailed, everyone. They're incredibly detailed in their creation. So it's just worthy. It kind of makes it the books worthwhile. Also, I like what you do, David, in the back matter of your book. You really tell the names and the players in a little bit more detail. And was that something you always had planned to do?
Yes, and for similar reasons. Yeah, the character log or the dramatis personae. I always thought that was great to have when I was reading books that had them because, for example, if Tolstoy were rewriting his book, I wish he would do that.
well, too late.
Yeah, too late. And then the same for, of course, I do use Latin, although I call it something else. But I thought, to have those in the back as well made sense. So it was basically things I had seen and other things that I liked, and I just wanted to put in. Thought it would help.
So that's studying what's out there, and then just seeing how you can incorporate that in. So In going back to the whole world building, I mean, you revealed many minutes ago that it's your recliner or your writing desk. So you had that all in internally, but did you ever have it laid out like a map to kind of think, okay, I'm going to go from here to there, and this is when this character pops up or this world changes or the dragons come in or anything like that, any visual like that?
No, the maps followed rather than led. It just happened to be a layout in my mind about how this journey had gone. I mean, we start with a fellow who's in the backwoods, and you have to get him to a sorcerer's college. So you start thinking about, well, what are the things that might happen, and what would terrain might be like, and in the Dark Ages, what were the roads like, and what was it likely to be in terms of villages that he might come to, and just that sort of thing. And one thing led to another in terms of thinking like that, and then that's when you just start setting it down on paper. I am aware that some people would make an outline first. And maybe have this or a visual, as you suggested. But for whatever reason, it just occurred to me to do it the other way around. I the ideas came, I wrote them down, and then the maps followed.
And that's how you kept intact. You said that you started writing in 98. But you also had told me that in previous conversations that you and I have had solo, that you had been thinking about this for a few decades before you actually started writing.
Yes.
Was there something that happened that triggered that, okay, I got to get going?
Well, as I approached the time when I was going to start thinking about, well, it's time to stop and do something else. Those ideas came more and more to my mind. But initially it was just, again, starting off with this idea of the fun and jokes at a wizard school. But as I kind of came back to it, I came back to it again and again. And I thought, well, now if we were to do that, how would that be? How would you explain it? How would you go about it? What would you have to add to make it plausible, more or less, in the fantasy world? So by the time I was ready to kind of really sit down and do it and work had slacked off a bit, I had the opportunity and I said, well, let's go. Time's flying.
That's right. Well, and what made you decide to use a pen name?
That's an old family name. Our family, as I understand it, originally came from the French part of Switzerland. And the Sauvain actually refers to people who were woodworkers at that time. And so the family started out in wood. timber. And so they, that surname came to them. And when they came over, eventually migrated here, I think in the late 1800s, they for some reason, for reasons not clear, they settled in Indiana. And they would say, you know, I am Frederick Savant. Well, in Indiana at the time, that was perhaps a little hard to say, and so it got turned into Sovine. So then they said, well, okay, I guess if it has to be Sovine, it's, we'll change the name. But I always thought at some point it might be fun to kind of go back to the original name. I had talked with my dad about it once, and he liked that idea, so that's what we did.
And that, so now you have it in perpetuity in your words. So I think about it. Listen, in our last 2 minutes, do you have any tips for our listeners who, whether they're writing fantasy or not, but how to really make a mark in the world of your book strategy? I mean, you're mostly on, you're on multiple social media platforms, but isn't it primarily Instagram?
Yes. And that mainly by accident, because I haven't a clue about any of this. Fortunately, I work with someone who understands marketing much better than I do, and she's very good at it. That was a lucky stroke. But I'm and you have told me, Judith, in the past that you have people who often want to come see you because they say, I just want to write. I don't want to do that marketing stuff. Well, I kind of felt the same way. It's hard because there's such different processes, but you can't really have the one without the other if you want to be successful. Now, if you want to write for a hobby, if you want to write and you have to write, but whether or not you sell or not, then it matters less. But if you want to get some return other than just emotional satisfaction from the writing, then you've got to do the marketing as well, as you have taught me.
As I have taught you, and you listened, and you've done well. David, do you ever see yourself writing in a different genre?
In fact, I've got a kind of story in mind. After this series of books is completed, I've got another story in mind of a very different situation, more historical fiction, actually. And I'm planning to toy around and play with that comes the day.
That sounds great. Well, I'm going to thank you for being with me the past hour. And I think our listeners got a lot out of it. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome, everyone. All right. Remember, as we go forward, your authoring and publishing success is always up to you. And remember, your words matter. We'll see you next week on another episode of Author You, Your Guide to Book Publishing. I'm Judith Briles.
Thank you for being a part of Your Guide to Book Publishing. Everything you want to know but didn't know what to ask. With your host, Dr. Judith Braun.